This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Poor People's Campaign organizes demonstrations in cities around the country. Community activists try to counter massive police sweeps in New York City. And the Trump administration tells the United Nations that poverty in the U.S. is not the UN's business.
But first, the world was surprised and most people were pleased, with the exception of American Democratic politicians, when Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un agreed to move towards lessening tensions on the Korean Peninsula. But two fierce war hawks, White House National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are still wild cards in the game, as is President Trump himself. We spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific author and political analyst who teaches history and African American studies at the University of Houston.
In order to understand U.S. policy towards the Korean Peninsula, you have to understand U.S. policy towards North Korea's closest neighbor. I'm speaking of the People's Republic of China. There is hysteria in Washington right now with regard to China being in the passing lane. That helps to explain the so-called trade war that is unfolding as we speak, with the United States rather arrogantly telling China that it's improper for Beijing to try to build world-class champions in such areas as artificial intelligence and green energy and quantum computing and robotization, and that they should just be dependent upon U.S. technology, even though the United States has just slapped a $1 billion fine upon ZTE, a major Chinese telecommunications giant, which was possible precisely because ZTE was heavily dependent upon U.S. technology for its chips. And so the United States would like that horse and rider relationship to continue indefinitely into the future, and China is balking. Which brings us to the North Korean question and the summit in Singapore. I think that Trump and Bolton and Pompeo, they are Mayberry Machiavellians. That is to say that they're trying to pull off something devious, akin to Nixon's overtures to China in the early 1970s, which flipped China into the anti-Soviet front and led directly to the collapse of the Soviet Union a few decades later. It seems to me, at least, that the United States is making these apparent concessions to North Korea because it would like to have on the Chinese border a friendly regime, that is to say, Pyongyang, in order to further pressure China. And I would also say that Washington probably is not adverse to a confederation between North and South, which would create a new superpower, a country of 100 million, speaking of a confederated Korea, with nuclear arms, which would at once threaten, from Washington's point of view, the number two and number three economies, speaking not only of China, but also Japan, which both Koreas have had rather difficult relations with stretching back decades. However, I don't think that the plans of these Mayberry Machiavellians will prove out, and this was indicated in part by Chairman Kim's trip to Beijing just a few days ago, where President Xi Jinping rolled out the red carpet for him, and I think that that may be an indication and a signal of where relations are going. Once again, it seems to me that the Democratic Party is thinking it could have gains by attacking the U.S. administration from the right, particularly in castigating the White House's attempt to back away from war games off the coast of North Korea, which are understandably seen as provocative. And it's unfortunate that Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and other Democrats have been hostile to this approach, and I think that they need to put their thinking caps on. And as a matter of fact, I think the entire progressive movement needs to put its thinking caps on, because I understand more than most the hostility towards Donald J. Trump, but we need more than hostility. We need an analysis. And interestingly enough, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson in London said that we should see method in the madness of Donald J. Trump. I think too often the Democrats and many of our friends on the left, they see the madness, but they don't see the method, which makes them oblivious to what I just sketched with regard to their larger plans on the Korean Peninsula.
Yes, it seems that all Democrats seem to see is Russians under every bed.
Well, that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate particularly because if you look at what's going on in the world right now, if you look at the recent comments by U.S. Ambassador in Berlin, Richard Grenell, who said that the United States would be seeking to empower right-wing populists, not only by reaching out to the neo-fascists in Austria, but also reaching out to the opponents of Chancellor Merkel in Berlin. And in fact, there are press reports indicating that Washington is now interested in regime change in Berlin. They would like to see Chancellor Merkel ousted in favor of someone to her right. And if you look at that situation, it would make sense for Berlin to then begin making overtures to Moscow. And note that in May 2018, Chancellor Merkel made two visits to Moscow to confer with Vladimir Putin. It's interesting to note that on May 9th, 2018, the day Moscow celebrates the victory over fascism, standing shoulder to shoulder with Vladimir Putin was Benjamin Netanyahu, of all people, who has made more than one pilgrimage to Moscow. President Rouhani of Iran has visited Moscow, I believe. President Erdogan of Turkey. Mr. Putin was in Beijing for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting at the same time that this Group of Seven meeting in Canada was blowing up. In fact, that was the fifth meeting in the past year between President Xi and President Putin. That does not include about two dozen other encounters by telephone. I mean, I know loving couples who have not had two dozen encounters over the past year or so. And so if you add that to the fact that stretching back to the days of the Soviet Union, Moscow's closest ally was India, then you begin to see that in some ways Washington is becoming isolated internationally, particularly with this trade war that is launched against the European Union, against China, against Canada, against Japan, etc., while Moscow is enjoying rather warm and close relations with most of those that are being antagonized by Washington, including, I should say, Shinzo Abe of Tokyo. A member of the royal family traveled to Moscow for the World Cup football matches, one of the first times in recent decades that a member of the royal family in Tokyo has been in Moscow. And of course, Shinzo Abe has been in Moscow repeatedly in recent years. So I would hope that the Democrats would do a sober assessment and recognize that they should take account of what I am discussing and describing, and that they should put up or shut up with regard to this idea that somehow Moscow interfered and intervened in the U.S. elections in November 2016. I guess sooner rather than later, we're going to see Moscow being blamed for this debacle along the Texas-Mexico border. But I understand, in a sense, why the Democrats don't want to do that analysis, because it's easier to point the finger overseas than to look at the rather hard white supremacy that is undergirding U.S. policy both domestically and globally, not least on the Texas-Mexico border as we speak.
And in terms of Russia and China, as it relates to North and South Korea, Russia has made overtures and had talks with South Korea about integration into the Chinese and Russian One Belt and Related Initiatives. That is, South Korea could be connected by land to those initiatives through China, but also through Russia via North Korea.
The One Belt, One Road Initiative is quite ambitious. Speaking of spending about perhaps $1 trillion on infrastructure, not least shipping lanes and railroads, etc. Already you have trains rumbling from the interior of China to the Iberian Peninsula in Europe. This bids fair to really remake the global economy, and I think this is what is undergirding U.S. foreign policy, and in fact helps to explain and shed light on why Mr. Trump just a day or two ago announced the formation of a so-called Space Corps, that is to say, a Star Wars fighting force militarizing outer space, which may be overly ambitious since the United States already, despite the less than positive relations with Moscow, is heavily dependent upon Russia for its manned ventures in outer space as we speak. And in any case, it speaks directly to why a recent United Nations panel has suggested that the United States is spending too much energy cutting aid to poor people in terms of health care, in terms of food stamps, et cetera, and why the U.S. administration is contemplating remaking the federal bureaucracy by adding what they would call, quote, welfare, unquote, programs to the Department of Health and Human Services. And given the denunciation over the years of the term welfare and the racializing of that term, that would be a predicate and a precursor to cutting those programs, particularly food stamps, which then raises the contradiction because, of course, not only would that hurt agribusiness, but it would also hurt states like Utah, where you have, interestingly enough, a number of residents of that virtually lily white state who are heavily dependent upon food stamps. So what we see is that with every passing day, the contradictions are ensnaring U.S. imperialism and leaving little room for exit beyond seeking to utilize the one remaining advantage of U.S. imperialism, which is the military advantage. But then again, that raises consequences right now too ghastly and ghoulish to contemplate, but even that may change.
And back to the tentative detente with North Korea, how does that jive with President Obama's and now President Trump's pivot to the Pacific and the increased militarization there?
Well, that is part of the equivalence, if you like, between the 44th and 45th presidents. That is to say, that recall that President Obama wanted a reset with Moscow, easing of tensions with Moscow so that energy could be redirected towards Asia, or more directly or more specifically towards China. When you read in the papers about Mr. Trump seeking a meeting in Vienna within days or weeks with President Putin, you see in some ways a recrudescence of the old Obama policy of the reset and the pivot. And what's interesting in that regard, and I would hope that analysts pay attention to this, is that during the week when there was the blow up in Quebec and the Singapore summit following that, you also had congressional hearings on the appointment of a new U.S. ambassador to South Korea. That person is one Harry Harris, and despite the surname, he is of Japanese ancestry, and I only mentioned that because he is also the leading anti-China hawk in the national security establishment, which rings alarm bells in China. Keep in mind that Harry Harris, before he was slated to be U.S. ambassador to South Korea, was the head of the U.S. Pacific Command. That is to say, he was an admiral and was in charge of seeking to intimidate the Chinese Navy in the South China Sea. That U.S. Pacific Command has now been renamed the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, which is more than a semantic change. It bespeaks this point that the United States would like to rope in New Delhi which has unresolved tensions and contradictions with China stretching back decades, at least to the 1962 war that they fought. And those tensions and contradictions have not been resolved, even though both China and India are part of the so-called Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which I mentioned a few moments ago, which is a counterpart and a counterpoint to the U.S.-nominated North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Now, by appointing or seeking to appoint Harry Harris as U.S. viceroy in South Korea, the United States is sending a loud signal to China about what its plans for the Korean Peninsula are, and I think that China has taken note and heed of that, which is why they rolled out the red carpet for Chairman Kim just a few days ago when he visited China.
You seem to be saying that the United States only takes steps to lessen hostilities in one area of the planet so that it can be free to become more bellicose in another.
Well, sure. And obviously what that speaks to is the fact that there has been a Copernican change since the end of World War II, when U.S. imperialism bestrode the planet like a colossus, not least because the Soviet Union had been devastated by Nazi warmongers from 1941 to 1945, by the fact that Japan had been subjected to atomic bombing in August 1945, by the fact that Western Europe also had been devastated by the war. But now things have changed, times have changed, and Washington is seeking to adjust and adapt to this changed reality. Part of the problem, I think, is that I don't think that the progressive movement, and the left-wing movement in particular, really understands the environment in which they're operating, which gives U.S. imperialism more confidence in its ability to affect the world situation than the situation calls for. What I mean is, it's rather shocking to see people surprised and stunned by the naked white supremacy and racism now being exerted on the Texas-Mexico border, as if this was not a country that was founded upon dispossession of the Native Americans and enslavement of the Africans, endured and countenanced Jim Crow apartheid for decades. But I think that to a certain extent, the progressive movement has swallowed the Kool-Aid, if you like, and has refused to look at the ugliness of U.S. imperialism. In some ways, it has even foisted that attitude upon foreign countries. For example, it seems as if Berlin is now taken aback by this idea that the White House would like to see regime change in Berlin. It's almost as if they thought that that was a kind of policy from Washington only slated for the global South, for Libya, for Iraq, for Afghanistan, but not for allies. But I think that what that speaks to is that with this ominous, from Washington's point of view, threat from China, the United States feels that allies have to become vassal states. I think that that is the explanation for the attack on Canada, for the attack on Berlin, that with these tariffs, you see that Washington wants to extract forcibly more wealth from its allies, in part to make up the shortfall delivered by tax cuts in December 2017, but more having a political significance, and feeling that it has to have vassal states tagging along behind Uncle Sam if it is to successfully confront China. I don't think that strategy will work, but we shall see shortly.
Yes, it has the potential to accelerate the decline, in fact, of U.S. imperialism.
Well, certainly that is the case. I mean, right now, the press, the bourgeois press, is telling us that the United States is having spectacular growth rates, but I agree with former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, now professor at Harvard, when he suggests this is like a sugar rush. In fact, the International Monetary Fund, in a recent analysis of the U.S. economy, more or less said the same thing, that the United States has pumped all of this capital into the economy through tax cuts to the wealthy, but this is a policy that is destined and doomed to end in tears, not least because, as a United Nations report just suggested, there are officially 40 million poverty-stricken people in this country. If you visit cities like San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles, in New York, you're stunned by the record numbers of homelessness. And so what you see is that U.S. imperialism is pursuing an unsustainable course, and it is a course that can only end in disaster.
Yes, the administration points to the job figures as evidence that the economy is on a boom and hugely healthy, but structurally that economy has changed, and the jobs that are created and those that remain are worse jobs.
Well, certainly that's the case, and we have not even touched upon the question of artificial intelligence and robotization, which will cut a prodigious swath through the levels of employment in this country, not only jeopardizing low-wage jobs, but also jeopardizing jobs of journalists, because already you have artificial intelligence devices that can write up articles about what happened at a city council meeting or what happened in the state legislature. With the technological revolution, you can have architectural blueprints drafted as easily in Manila as in Milwaukee. Likewise, with regard to the same kinds of telecommunications devices, you can have lawyers' pleadings drafted as easily in New Delhi as in New York. And so it's not just low-wage jobs that are about to be hit like a hurricane by the advancement of the productive forces of society, but also jobs of the middle strata. And that is just around the corner, just around the corner, of course, are driverless automobiles and driverless vehicles, which will basically lead to a shakeout, not only in the taxi industry, which is already being devastated by Uber and Lyft, leading to taxi drivers in New York committing suicide on a record level, but also eliminating jobs of truck drivers as well. So this is the rather grim scenario that we're facing in this country. And it reminds me of the slogan from the 1930s, organize or starve.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn speaking from Houston.
The Poor People's Campaign staged a mass rally in Washington, D.C., and companion demonstrations were held in other cities around the country this weekend. The campaign is intended to reignite the movement for social and economic justice that Dr. Martin Luther King was trying to forge when he was assassinated 50 years ago. Reverend Graylin Hagler, the senior pastor at the Plymouth United Church of Christ in Washington, is active in the Poor People's Campaign.
I was arrested 3 times in this campaign. The last time for praying in front of the Supreme Court. And we were held for 28 hours in leg irons, handcuffs, body chains, and in the most inhumane conditions in D.C.'s jail, which was roach-filled. And the bed was basically a metal pan, a metal tray that was built supposedly to have a mattress on it at some point, but it did not have a mattress. And, of course, it hasn't been cleaned. And there were roaches crawling all over that. So basically the whole time in jail, I was spent basically trying to kill roaches. And then we were taken out 7 o'clock the next morning over to D.C. Superior Court, supposedly for arraignment. Then it was decided in the afternoon that we were in the wrong court, needed to be lugged over to federal court for arraignment, and was arraigned 7 p.m. the following evening. And so basically we were charged with what they call parading, and our passports was ordered confiscated.
Now, this Poor People's Campaign is modeled after, of course, Dr. King's project in 1968. Dr. King foresaw it as a movement that would work towards national transformation. But, of course, Dr. King was assassinated before the campaigns set up in the tent city in Washington, D.C. What kind of transformation are we looking for in this Poor People's Campaign?
Well, one of the issues is to begin to change the political narrative in the country. When we look at the sort of the political narrative that we have seen, it's been divisive, it's been xenophobic, it's been an endorsement of white supremacy, and it has engaged in the worst kind of draconian policies. And so what we try to do is sort of the build up, one, change the political narrative, the political discourse that takes place and takes shape in the country. Out of all of the debates that led up to the election of a president, you did not hear at one point anybody really talk about sort of the social economic issues that plague people in this country, other than this protectionism. But we didn't talk about poor people. We didn't talk about the folks on the margins. That's the other thing. And the thing is also is that through the commercial media, there has been a stereotyping of faith groups. And the faith groups that have been lifted up by commercial media has been those reactionary groups, the white evangelicals, the folks that are just against everybody who is not white, against everything. And at the same time, we have a whole host of voices of faith that's been doing good things and working very hard throughout the years. And so also it's a way in which we begin to emerge and those voices and lift up a whole discussion that is very different in nature, that really talks to the heart and the soul of the nation. And clearly we recognize that we got to continue to build and agitate and build and agitate, because our mistake very often is to cease in our agitation, because not only do we need to change the narrative of the country, but we need to change the narrators of the country.
And of course, Dr. King was very much focused on peace, but certainly Donald Trump's peace credentials, despite what happened in Singapore, are not good. And the Democrats at this point in history seem more pro-war than ever, and sometimes more pro-war than the Republicans.
Okay, so what's the question?
Well, that is the political environment that this Poor People's Campaign confronts.
Well, you know, we've had major pieces around militarism and talk about militarism in terms of a robbery of the resources that can be used in terms of the social infrastructure of the country. You know, the fact is that the military ended up in this budget getting more money than they even asked for, which basically allows the military to go on the spending spree. In terms of Singapore, nobody knows what happened in Singapore. You know, the only thing that we really know of is that they got together. Maybe they decided to build a hotel. I don't know what happened in Singapore. But the reality is that we are facing the militarization of not only the nation, not just in the military, but also in local police departments. So when you begin to create a surplus of money so that the military can go on a spending spree, half of those weapons end up getting passed on to local police departments, which of course get used in local communities and always against the poor.
Yes, in 2014, an amendment was offered to the Congress and put up for a vote by the whole House that would have abolished the 1033 Pentagon program for militarization of local police. But at that time, 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted against the amendment and for continuation of 1033.
Well, you know, it's people locked in a political paradigm that they can't break loose and they're too afraid to break loose from. And that's the reason why we have the Poor People's Campaign that begins to lift up the kind of moral equation that we really need to be about as a people and as a nation. But the fact is that our sacred texts are texts that speaks to peace. It speaks to justice. It speaks to those on the margins. And that's what we really want to begin to lift up, because somehow folks like to believe that because they fit into this political paradigm and do and engage in a political discourse that seems to protect the nation and protect the military, that they're somehow doing the right thing when they're not doing the right thing at all, but it's the wrong thing.
Yes, and this huge military budget does not augur well for the social safety net, which is part of the agenda, defense of that safety
right.
net for the Poor People's Campaign.
And it's not just the safety net. It's the type of things that, if you want to talk about the expenditures of money, what we should be spending money on. Should be spending money on education. We should be spending money on health care. We should be spending money so that people actually have a living wage. I mean, those are the areas that we should be spending money on, because basically the only thing when you spend money in military, you're spending money in death and destruction. And you're building nothing up. You're tearing things down and destroying things. And so our whole thing is that if you're going to engage in protecting the culture, the society, then the protection of the culture and the society comes in doing things that build up people on the margins, people who are trying to be educated, people who are trying to go to higher learning, people who are trying to have health care, those who need to have a living wage. You protect the earth from ecological devastation that is going on. You've got to address systemic racism and the ways it has been used and utilized to continue to dispossess poor, and not only poor blacks, but poor whites as well, because they are led to operate against their own best interests based upon this paradigm of white supremacy.
Have you been encouraged by the alliances, the connections, and the kinds of crowds that the Poor People's Campaign has been able to attract so far?
Definitely, definitely. And one of the things that you find is that there's a lot of young people in the movement, a lot of young 30-year-olds, many of them going into the ministry or into the rabbinical schools or coming from different faith traditions, but you see a lot of young folks.
That was Reverend Grayland Hagler in Washington, D.C.
The New York City Council recently held hearings on policing in the nation's largest city. Black and brown activists attempted to get the council to curb the NYPD's massive raids and mass arrests in public housing projects. The police maintain a list containing the names of 42,000 alleged gang members. That has grown by 70% since Mayor Bill de Blasio took office. One of those that spoke before the city council was Siddiqui Brothership Olukbala of the Stop the Raids Coalition. He says the police trotted out their high-ranking black cops to put the best face on their mass arrest policies.
They lied, straight up. I mean, everything that came out with their little charts and their little statistics, the thing that got to me and for a lot of people that are there was that, as usual, they were the first ones to testify, do their presentation, and then when they were finished, they packed up their ball and they ran off the court. You know, they didn't have the decency or the respect to stay there and listen to the other testimonies. They didn't want to hear from the people. And, you know, all the things that they talked about was, you know, how they really care about the community and how their database is set up to save lives and this and that and the other, but yet they didn't have, again, the respect to even stay there and listen to other people. And not just them, but even the council people. You know, they would come in, they said what they had to say. For the most part, you know, they left. They didn't even stay to the end. They didn't stay to listen to everyone. And, you know, that's a little disturbing. When you just look at that, just a matter of respect. Yeah, I know everybody's busy and that's not the only thing on their table. But my whole thing is that if you have this on your schedule, the police department actually postponed it because they had a schedule for another day, then you make it your business to at least stay there and listen to what other people have to say so that way you can open up some dialogues. But the reality is they really don't care about the community, and their whole premise is that, oh, well, because of this database and goes all the way back to Comstat and all the other things they're utilizing, that they have actually brought crime down in the communities, which is a fallacy. Crime in our communities has gone down because of the people in the communities. Someone who lives in the community, I know that for a fact. You can walk through neighborhoods now, you don't see crack vials all over the grounds and everything because of the people who dealt with it. People, there's still illicit, illegitimate capitalism that goes on, but it's not out in the street like it was. Yes, there are some casualties that take place in our communities and everybody else's communities. You know, we don't have to get into the whole thing about who has guns and who doesn't and where they come from, but just the whole idea that our communities are under siege is a lie. The only siege that's going on is by that biggest gang in the city, which is dressed in blue.
And what do you mean the community dealt with it, meaning the drug problem?
Because, you know, it's not like it was in the 80s and in the 90s. They're taking credit for all of this. But if you walk through the streets, yeah, there's still unemployed youth on the corners, and some of them might be engaged in the illegitimate capitalism, and others are not. They're just unemployed. They're just hanging out in their neighborhood. And those are the ones who are being targeted and scooped up. We have people that testify in terms of the gang raids that are going on, which is like, you know, one of the biggest assaults that the police department is doing now. And they're using that database to justify it. Guilt by association. Entire housing projects are being raided. You know, hundreds of black and brown youth are being taken out of their homes and locked up, no real legal representation. Most of them made to take a plea, and then they end up throwing it under the dungeons. The parents are being threatened that if they go to the media, or if they say anything about what happened, that's going to be bad for their children, so they don't know what to do. And so we're organizing around that, but folks are afraid to deal with it. They say, oh, it's a drug gang, or it's an armed, you know, menace to this community. And they listen to what the mainstream corporate media is saying. You know, a lot of this goes back to, in 1979, the NYPD published a book. It was called Street Gangs Profiles for Police. It was written by this guy, Sergeant H. Craig. And that's basically their Bible in terms of gangs. You know, how they deal with that, you know, with that whole gang intelligence units. You know, we can all go back to 71 when the NYPD and Chicago police gang units, along with the FBI, they came together and they basically initiated that whole gang intelligence strategy that they had used in Chicago. You know, when they killed and murdered Fred Hampton and attacked the Panther Party there, you know, that was the gang unit that did that. You know, along with the federal, you know, government. But when these raids take place, it's the Fed. The NYPD people that testify, particularly Shea, you know, he lied straight up. He said that all the data in their database was not shared with anybody else, that was kept internally within the NYPD, which was a lie. Because if you have a raid and you see ICE there and you see an ATM there and you see the FBI there, and you see Homeland Security there in the projects along with the NYPD, then obviously they're sharing information because that's how they're doing that. You know, they're coming in, and most of the charges are federal. So that was a mistruth.
And more than 42,000 people are in this database, many of whom have no criminal record. And it's not clear what you have to do or who you have to be to get on that list.
Exactly. They never said that. You know, they said they had their criteria, but they were never specific about what exactly that criteria is. The only thing I can think amongst is that going back, you know, again to the omnibus crime bill, you know, from black folks' hero Clinton. When that was passed, they actually identified what a gang member looks like or what a gang is. And, you know, basically it came down to 5 points. An identified leader, that they hang in the same areas, that they dress in the same colors, and that if at least two people in that group have felonies, then it's a gang. And that's a basketball team. Identify leaders, the captain. Of course, they wear the same team colors. They hang in the same neighborhoods and they go to the same places, whether it's practice or school or wherever it is. And so if two people on that team are there, then that's a gang. So that can be used anywhere and everywhere to say that this is a gang. And that's what they're doing. And so like in the projects, the situation is that you have families that are being evicted because not if someone in their family was convicted, but if they were just arrested. So anyone that got arrested in these raids, you know, whether it be the Bronx 120 or the 104, I believe, that from Grand Houses, and they just recently hit two projects in Brooklyn, it's going on. And so what they're doing is they're telling the families again, well, if you don't cooperate, then we can kick you out of public housing. And that's what they've been doing, and that's what they're threatening to do. So it's a whole assault on our community by, you know, getting rid of the youth, taking them out, changing the whole dynamics of the community. Because you take all those youth out of the neighborhood, then what's left?
Yes, it appears to some of us that the NYPD, in collaboration with the city government, is creating the most hostile environment possible for public housing residents and poor folks and black folks in general, and that this has a great deal to do with gentrification.
Yes, they've already begun making condominiums out of some of the public housing in the city already. That's already being done now as we speak.
Now, you say the city council is very lackluster, to say the least, in examining this issue, and that includes council members from the affected housing projects and neighborhoods.
Absolutely. I mean, there's 51 council districts in New York City, and there's no such thing as any district that does not have a housing project. You know, it's interesting because we were down at court for this hearing, and we were walking to get to the vehicle that was parked on the east side near the river, and we walked through Alfred E. Smith housing projects. I had never witnessed anything like this in my life, Glenn. The trees were pruned. The grass was green. I mean, the place looked beautiful. It didn't look like a housing project that I know of, and it was definitely New York Housing Authority. As we need to do a video on this, show people what this particular housing project looks like, which was primarily Caucasian and Asian folks that were there. And it was like, I've lived in New York all my life, all my 63 years. I ain't never seen a housing project look like that. And just looking at that, you can see where they're going. I mean, they had artwork in the middle of the grass, you know, sculptures and plaques, and I mean, lighting all over the place, fresh benches. I mean, you wouldn't believe what this place looks like.
And not a young black or Hispanic male that fits the usual profile to be seen.
Nope, I didn't see anybody out there. No one hanging out. It was pristine. But, you know, all that said, yeah, it's gentrification straight up. It's just another tactic that they're utilizing. And I agree with that article in terms of, since they allegedly got rid of stop and frisk, which is, I don't think that's true either, because I still see them harassing people around in the community. And if you talk to the brothers on the block, they'll tell you that it's still going on. But, corporate media doesn't do that. They won't go. They're afraid to go in the neighborhood for the most part and talk to the people. And they don't walk the streets. I mean, the whole idea that, like I said, our communities are under siege within themselves. I mean, children still play. Grandmothers still go to the store. There's still life in our communities. And to say that, you know, the police need to be, that's another thing, too. We're trying to get the organizations here to begin to see that they need to come together and, you know, look at the whole issue of community control over the police, because it's not a total solution, but it's more than people just protesting and rah-rahing and this and not doing anything. Folks, for the most part, they don't go to community board meetings. They don't go to those precinct meetings. And the only people who are there are usually elders who the police, they scared them into agreeing with them that, yes, we need more police. We need more police. We need more police. And that's not the solution, especially when you have police who don't live in our neighborhoods, don't really care. They have no vested interest in anything that goes on. And a lot of them, you know, really want to destroy the community itself. You can't look at police as the ones who want to bring crime down, because their job is to keep crime up. That's how they make their living. So, you know, the contradictions with all of that that's being said, and using those so-called technological advances and keeping records, it's just false, straight up. And people really need to wake up to what's going on. And again, you know, just like I mentioned earlier, you know, with the whole issue of the national anthem and the patriotism and standing for the flag and jets flying over and the whole military mind that's going on with what is, you know, George Jackson has said, fascism is already here. And people need to understand what's going on and begin to organize and put their ideologies aside, put their own, you know, methods of work aside, and begin to really work with the community and with the people. If you really support the families who are being victimized by not just the gang raids, but there's the immigration ICE raids, there's those who lost their children to police murder, there's those whose families are still in prison for 40 and 50 years due to the COINTELPRO, which is really what this is again. Our political prisoners that are locked up, those families, all those families should come together. And we actually did put together a 10-point platform for organizations to actually look at, you know, to help the families and to work with the families and get the families unified together. And that's how you're going to deal with this. And don't leave them stranded, so that if there's a raid comes up tomorrow and they hit one of the housing projects, at least we have an apparatus that can respond within a couple of days, you know, to deal with that. But it needs to be enhanced, and it can't happen unless the communities that those projects exist in begin to organize themselves. So that way, when police come, that there's a mechanism set up and a structure to have an immediate response, so that when youth get locked up, that our media is able to put it out that there was a raid that just took place in Edenmore Projects and such people were captured and they need legal assistance. The parents are being harassed. We need security in the projects. You know, all those things need to be part of that organizing. You know, you need to have a war chest. You need to have funds that can, you know, retain real lawyers and not just public defenders who you're just, you know, a number.
Well, has this response been adequate in terms of those who were captured in the Bronx more recently and in the Harlem housing projects a couple of years ago.
There's been response, but it's not where it should be. I mean, you have a handful of seasoned activists that can deal with it. You have a lot of young people who are really interested and dedicated to doing that work. But then you have the organizations that can help that won't do it. Again, because of their own partisanship and their own ideologies, they won't work with each other. They say, oh, that's not the right way. And this is it's not about that. It's about what can we do concretely to support these communities and not be afraid to walk in those communities. And when you go into a community, don't come there with your revolutionary newspapers and telling black people that they're oppressed. We know we're oppressed. We don't need that. What we need is some concrete assistance and using your printing that skills and resources that you have to put some flyers around the neighborhood and say there's going to be a meeting, you know, or publishing your newspapers what's really going on. Using the radio airwaves, you know, doing like what you're doing right now. Being able to respond for the community and not for your own agenda.
There were some who wishfully thought that Bill de Blasio would be part of the solution, but he's the one under whom this huge database, this gang list, was created.
Yeah, and you know, I was done with him. You know, Malcolm X Day, he spoke at the ceremony that was there, and, you know, a couple people stood up and applauded. I'm wondering why he was invited there to speak after he had said that Herman Bell should not be released, you know, after 40 years of being a political prisoner from the Panther Party. I mean, that was enough for me. I would never stand for him, just like I would never stand for no national anthem. But that database, again, that's developed out of the Comstat, which preceded that. And, again, I go back again to that whole gang intelligence era of the 70s. You know, they had 3 points from the NYPD. Gang intelligence said, number one, there's always the fear and concern by the police that an individual or organization with electrifying charisma may appear on the scene and unite the thousands of gang members throughout the city. And I know that sounds familiar to you. Then they have another one that says, in past years, questionable adult groups and organizations are alleged to have been in contact with youth street gangs in an apparent attempt to exploit and utilize the potential force and power of the cliques. The development may eventually present the most serious ramifications to the police. And last but not least, at one time or another during the past 8 years, this again was written in 79, the following groups or organizations have contacted youth street gangs in New York City. The Young Lords, the Black Panthers, the Muslims, New African Puerto Rican Independence Movement, Rastafarians, Black Liberation Army, Five Percenters. And it says many of the above groups and organizations are known to be militant, revolutionary, anti-police, criminal, or negative in concept. So that's COINTELPO's word for word, but just adjusted to attack street organizations, also known to them as gangs.
That was Siddiqui Brothership Olukbala of the Stop the Rage Coalition in New York City.
The United States last week withdrew from the United Nations Council on Human Rights. The U.S. pullout was largely in solidarity with its ally, Israel. But Washington was also embarrassed by a report to the Council on entrenched poverty in the United States. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley said the U.N. should stick to problems in countries like Rwanda and Burundi. At Sputnik Radio, hosts Brian Becker and John Kariakou discussed the U.N. report on poverty in the U.S. with Ajabu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace and Aislinn Pulley, an organizer with Black Lives Matter Chicago. Ajabu Baraka said,
"But I think that the stats really speak for themselves, and it is reflective of a real concern within the context of human rights law. What Haley is referring to in terms of trying to divert attention away from that devastating report is the fact that the U.S. does not recognize economic, social, and cultural rights as, in fact, human rights. But Philip Alston and his mandate as a special rapporteur is required to have a comprehensive analysis of human rights practices of all states. So the fact that the U.S. is in violation of all of the terms of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, is in fact the real source of the issue that Haley has.
Aislinn, let's bring you in. Again, this is what the rapporteur says, and it's just along the lines of what Ojamo is saying. Quote, "The United States is alone among developed countries in insisting that while human rights are of fundamental importance, they do not include rights that guard against dying of hunger, dying from a lack of access to affordable health care, or growing up in a context of total deprivation." I mean, these are a true report. I mean, really true and absolutely accurate about how the U.S. functions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's extremely accurate, and I think it's revealing to those who haven't been paying attention. I'm in Chicago, and Chicago, in many cases, has been a leader in terms of the attack on the poor. Rahm Emanuel conducted the largest public school closing in the history of the United States by closing over 50 schools. Rahm Emanuel closed half of the city's mental health care centers. All of these things that have been attacks to services for the people and to the public good have resulted in increased poverty and all of the consequences that result from poverty, including increases in intra-communal violence. And what we've seen systemically is that instead of addressing the causes of economic inequality, which of course includes the behemoth of capitalism and all the services that exist within it, it also is further impacted by removing services from communities. And that has caused the increase in violence. And we've seen that from the increase in street violence in Chicago, the increase in mass school shootings. This is a total betrayal of the societal agreement between the government and its people. And we're seeing the social welfare of entire populations throughout this country impacted on a level that we haven't seen since the Great Depression.
One of the points that the report highlights is that the United States has the highest rate of income inequality among Western countries. The $1.5 trillion in tax cuts in December 2017 overwhelmingly benefited the wealthy and worsened the inequality. It says the United States ranks 18th out of 21 wealthy countries in terms of labor markets, poverty rates, safety nets, wealth inequality, and economic mobility. And in 2018, the United States had 25%, that's one out of four, of the world's 2,208 billionaires. It's really, Ojamo, in spite of all of the Democratic sort of branding, it's a tale of two countries. There is the very, very, very rich, and then a vast part of the population that's actually very, very poor.
You know, that's exactly right. And that's why it's so problematic when you see how this report is being covered by the mainstream press. They are framing this as a report critical of Trump-era policies. But we know, because we were in contact with Alston and his team during 2017, and we know reality, that this report is an analysis of the structural contradictions within the U.S. that preceded the Trump administration. That basically what we're looking at is the consequences of neoliberal policies that have been supported by both of the bourgeois parties, and the social and economic consequences are quite obvious and reflective in that report. So this notion that this is a consequence of Trump policies is a gross distortion, and it's really helping to undermine where the attention of this report really should be, which is on the structural contradictions of this backward, racist, neoliberal capitalist system.
You know, one of the things that struck me, too, about this report was its contention that American society right now is structured in such a way that it's actually undermining our foundation of democracy, where we like to talk about one man, one vote. We like to talk about the fact that we're a participatory democracy. But in fact, we have among the lowest voter turnout of any industrialized democratic nation on earth. And so there really isn't one man, one vote here in the United States. And people who are marginalized economically are also marginalized politically. And so the poorer they get, the weaker they get, and it's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it reveals the delusion of, you know, American exceptionalism, and it exposes the contradiction between the rhetoric and the reality. The reality is that we've never had one man or one person, one vote, right? There's always been exceptions. There have been exceptions to who was considered human and who was considered property. And there was exceptions to gender, right? Women only were able to win the vote less than 100 years ago. And then full access to voting rights were not obtained until, the late 60s, for Black people. And then we still receive a huge negative impact from the fact that there are so many of our people locked up who cannot vote. And so there are so many ways in which the reality shows us that we have never had one person, one vote in this country. And there have been consistent and persistent efforts to make sure that that does not happen. We have the Electoral College, which is a vestige of slavery that still is in place, which prevents a direct democratic vote. And I think all of that is reflected in the reasons why, and this report highlights that the United States is incredibly unequal, and it is set up that way. And in order to maintain its inequality and to maintain the dominance of the billionaire class, all of these provisions are put in place.
In 2016, nearly 20% of all children were living in poverty. Children comprise 32% of all people in poverty. 20% of children live in relative income poverty. And contrary to stereotypical assumptions, 31% of poor children are white, 24% are Black, 36% are Latino, and 1% are indigenous. That is consistent with the fact that the United States ranks 25th out of 29 industrialized nations in investing in early childhood education. Ajamu, it's not about Trump. This is the system.
Exactly. And what's important about this conversation is for people to understand that all of these issues are, in fact, human rights issues. And while we are looking at economic, social, and cultural rights, the fact of the matter also, too, is that the U.S. is in violation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, moving child offenders to adult prisons, the use of deadly force, the impunity of the police officers, the death penalty for child offenders. This all amounts to a conclusion that's quite clear to most of us, that the U.S. is a systematic violator of the fundamental human rights of people in this country.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back.